I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Lisa Herzog, professor of political philosophy and theory at the Technical University of Munich. We're discussing her 2018 book, Reclaiming the System, Moral Responsibility, Divided Labor, and the Role of Organizations in Society, from Oxford University Press. Herzog works on the political philosophy of markets, the history of political and economic ideas, ethics and organizations, and economic democracy. She is the author of Inventing the Market, Smith, Hegel, and Political Theory, from Oxford University Press, Freiheit gehört nicht nur den Reichen, from C.H. Beck, as well as several edited volumes and many articles. So, first of all, let me say, Lisa Herzog, thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thanks for inviting me.
Lisa, I love the book. It's a great examination of the nature of modern organizations and the challenges to keeping these organizations to a kind of moral standard, and a strategies for reclaiming the system, as you say in the title. Another striking feature of the book is that you incorporate qualitative social science, some interviews with professionals in an interesting way. So first of all, let me say thank you for the book. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Yeah, why don't you say a little bit at the top about what motivated you to write this book? Why did you take up this particular topic at this particular time?
Yeah, well, it was shortly after the financial crisis, and I had just finished my PhD, which then became a book about markets. And I watched all the news about the financial crisis and what happened there, and I was also starting my own first job teaching at a university, and I realized that a lot of that had been going on in the financial crisis was not just markets going wild, but individuals in complex organizations somehow not functioning the way that were supposed to function, and maybe they weren't even doing it with evil intentions, but somehow this whole constellation of these very large, complex organizations, lots of experts doing very specialized tasks, they would run wild and do a lot of morally relevant harm to society. And at the same time, I was experiencing all the rules and regulations and the culture at an institution. And so this question emerged in my mind, what does it mean for individuals to be that cog in the wheel of large organizations from 9 to 5, 5 days a week? And what does it mean for our society that our economy is to a great extent structured by these big organizations? And well, that's how I started exploring organizational theory and then also started doing interviews with people, because I felt that this is a topic for which I need to talk to people who have more experience than I had.
Mm-hmm. Did your, just out of curiosity, because I know your work on Hegel and Smith, did this work emerge out of the historical interest, or was it vice versa, that the Hegel and Smith were sort of triggered by this interest?
I can't really separate the historical and the systematic dimension. I mean, that's probably the German philosophical education, where these things are more integrated than in the Anglo-Saxon world. My motive for going to Smith and Hegel was very much to understand where our ideas about markets come from. Mm-hmm. So it was a systematic intention with which I read the historical texts. But then, of course, the historical texts also gave me ideas about today's world. And one thing that one can take from both Smith and Hegel is the way in which human beings are social animals and how our social contexts have an impact on us. And we like to imagine ourselves as these rational, autonomous beings. But actually, when you read Smith and Hegel, and also if you look at a lot of psychological studies and at the world around you, it's clear that social contexts have an impact on us. And that's why the argument that I then try to make in the book is that, well, if social contexts have an impact on us, then we need to take responsibility collectively for the kind of social context that we build for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Was Smith or Hegel particularly an influence in the theory behind this book? Do you think of yourself more as a Smithian or a Hegelian in this book, or neither?
Well, I guess a left Hegelian with a lot of pragmatism thrown in as well. So this idea of ethical life in Hegel, Sittlichkeit, that's very much what I've just described, that we are shaped by our environment. This whole idea that human beings need to live an ethical life in a community. We cannot just ask about abstract principles of justice. We need to look at the institutions, both the formal and the informal ones, to understand how morality and ethics work on the ground. That very much inspired the book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Hegel, of course, has this, as you well know, the view about civil society in which has a kind of moralized version of the institutions of civil society are crucial to the development of ethical life.
He calls them corporations, but right. It's actually very short and pretty vague, and it's not quite clear what he means. It's certainly not what we call corporations today, but this idea that you're shaped by your professional or occupational context, that's similar.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let's start out by talking about what is an organization, and then we'll get to the moral components to it first. So maybe just as a definitional matter, what do you mean by organizations? What do you include within them as far as examples go? And what are the main features of an organization?
Well, I can't give you a definition with necessary and jointly sufficient conditions, because I think it's more like a family resemblance concept. But I think there are features that lots of organizations share. And one thing to note that may seem unusual in the context of political philosophy is that I look both at public and at private organizations. So in political philosophy, we often have this divide between government institutions and the private economy, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. But within this private economy, we find lots of large organizations that are actually structured quite similarly to public bureaucracies. So the features that I look at are, so we have organizations that have divided roles bundled together by rules and hierarchies. And then they have a culture that develops because individuals have these roles within these structures. And that's something that you find both in, say, a public bureaucracy and a large private company.
Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about this because it strikes me as somewhat unusual to bring together nonprofit and profit, for-profit organizations together in one umbrella concept.
Yeah,
I mean,
it was a surprise to myself as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm just wondering if at the back, I mean, the sort of profit motive at all, you know, shapes or you know, inflects how one thinks about it. I mean, maybe just say a little bit more as a way to sort of justify why you can treat both under the same umbrella term.
Well, the first thing that I realized is that a lot of sociological and organizational theories actually do treat them together. So it's not just me making this move. Mm-hmm. Of course, the profit motive makes a difference in lots of private companies, but then lots of public institutions also act on the monetary pressures because they have budgets, they have to fulfill certain tasks within a certain time span. And so they often, they make individuals experience the same kinds of pressures. And it doesn't come from markets, but from other institutions, from hierarchies, whatever. But the subjective experience that you have to fulfill certain tasks with scarce means, that's actually quite similar. And then so that was sort of the theoretical framework that I discovered in organizational theory and sociology. But then also the interviews that I did, I talked to people in private companies and I talked to people in semi-private companies and in public institutions. And it really did turn out that lots of the experiences, for example, about how to deal with strict rules and if you experience cases that don't quite fit the rules, that those things are pretty similar. And so I thought, okay, let's focus on the things that private companies and public institutions have in common without wanting to deny that there can still be lots of other differences.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you're looking at relatively large organizations, correct? What's the approximate size of the organizations you're looking at?
Actually, one of my interviewees was working in a startup that was just getting to the point where they really had to introduce internal structures. Mm. I can't give you a hard number, like beyond 50 employees or whatever, you then have to have these kinds of structures. But it's clear that it's not all face-to-face anymore. Mm. You cannot just gather everyone every morning and decide spontaneously what everyone is going to do. You have formal roles, you have some kinds of rules about what's allowed and what's not allowed, and you have some kinds of hierarchies. So whenever that's true of an organization, then that's something that would fall into the scope of what I'm trying to cover.
Yeah, that's good. Hierarchies and the division of labor are crucial in your account to the organizations. This doesn't play a large role in your book, but I was somewhat curious as far as how these organizations developed. Because they're so ubiquitous in the contemporary world, I think one has to remind oneself that these things are not natural features of the cosmos. Yeah. So is it, how did these organizations develop? It's a very long story, but as far as, in any points that you want to add that might be relevant to the argument, how particularly these issues about hierarchy and division of labor emerged, because certainly these things are not necessary features of one can imagine organizations that are not hierarchical and don't have divisions of labor. So how do those things emerge?
Well, I guess it's a story that starts in the early modern world when you have public bureaucracies, but you also have private companies, networks of merchants that exploit the economies of scale that you can take advantage of if you divide labor. And the basic story, which I think has a true core, is that the division of labor just allows us to be more productive. Mm-hmm. And that's why once you get this idea to spread and more people try to do it, you can imagine that depending on the industry, of course, but in lots of industries, it just makes sense for companies to be larger than their costs are lower, and that's why these models spread. The Industrial Revolution is pretty important, of course, because that's where, because of the kind of machinery they use and the kind of technologies they had, large organizations really made a lot of sense. But of course, there's also the legal dimension of how the legal history of these things evolved. And that's not something I've worked on, but other people are doing very interesting work on this. I can highly recommend David Chipley's work on the history of the corporation. And what he argues is that for private companies to be run as large corporations that are legal persons, you needed a privilege from the government to have this legal shell, as it were, that is a corporation which is not owned by the owners. The owners are just the owners of the shares, as it were. We call them owners because we are not used to these legal details. And that legal form has also spread across the world. And it's not the only one that we see around. And as you said, there's no necessity of having these kinds of organizations. I think there is maybe not a necessity, but there are good reasons to have large organizations in some areas, just because the economies of scale are really so large and we wouldn't want to forgo these. And also certain kinds of highly specialized work that fulfills important purposes can only be done if you have large organizations. So if you think about a large hospital that has all the different divisions of different kinds of medicine, you need them to be integrated so that they can treat patients in a sort of integrated way, but each fulfilling their own tasks. And that's just, if you like, a cultural achievement to have come up with this idea to organize work in these kinds of structures that I don't think will go away, even though new technologies might change the structures and the power relations and so on. But as long as we have divided labor, we need ways of integrating it, because divided labor always also needs to be integrated back into what it's supposed to do by being divided. So you need production processes and so on. And in that sense, there are some people who say that with the internet, we're only going to have work in projects and very flexible networks and so on in the future. I don't think that's going to happen, just because having certain forms is useful and helps us to get things done that we want to get done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the division of labor analysis in your book is I thought was really quite exciting, and I hadn't quite thought about that sort of dimension. I think there are a lot of different books that are out there that are on the hierarchy points rather than the division of labor point, and thinking of books like the one by Elizabeth Anderson on the dictatorship or whatever it is of the modern
private government
right. So there's a sort of analysis of the sort of democratization of modern corporations, but your particular take on the division of labor is quite interesting, and we'll get into that in a minute. So let's shift over to the, so you take a kind of moral analysis of modern organizations, which, as you point out in the book, is very much understudied, to say the least, insofar as there is a kind of moral analysis of these types of organizations. I take it comes a large part from the Frankfurt School and from somebody like Habermas, whom you mention in the book. Maybe you could say a little bit about your approach to a moral analysis of organizations and how it differs from say, Habermas or any others.
Mm-hmm. Well, I try to be minimalistic in a sense, because I want people with lots of different moral backgrounds to be able to make sense of what I say in the book. So I try to rely on very basic moral norms that people with different backgrounds could agree on, like do not harm third parties without any good justification, and do not harm the environment. So it's a sort of basic norms that are in the core of all moral systems, basically. Habermas and other people from the Frankfurt School, I think in some ways they have a more demanding approach, because they are also thinking about, for example, avoiding alienation and having good work, or in Habermas terms, having the norms of the life world in a more demanding sense than what I do. Maybe also to be valid in the system. So some might describe my approach as more liberal, in the sense that it's a sort of a liberal egalitarian core of morality. And that's all I want to rely on. And that may sound minimalistic, but if you think about where we are with this economic system that we see at the moment, that climate change and all forms of exploitation and injustice and inequality that we produce at the moment, even those very basic norms aren't actually basic at all in what they imply when they are taken seriously in practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. And you said, I think, anticipated the answer to my next question, which is about the notion of morality that you employ in the book. It struck me as somewhat of a minimalist attempt at a kind of overlapping consensus.
To be ecumenical, if you like.
Yeah, good. I mean, maybe to say maybe a little bit more, if you can. I mean, what are the kinds of main violations of the moral code that you see or have seen in the organizations that you particularly have in mind?
Well, if you take something like the financial crisis again, you have bankers who want to make money. You have regulatory authorities that are supposed to look after the structures of the financial market. You have private people wanting to buy houses. Everyone seems to be doing harmless things with good intentions. And somehow what you end up with is a huge financial crisis that sends lots of people into unemployment, breaks up families, makes people lose their houses. And that also has an impact on the economies of other countries worldwide. And that's the kind of situation where lots of people seemingly doing harmless things leads to a big moral catastrophe. And climate change has a similar kind of structure. You can also take more small-scale examples. For example, the Challenger disaster that I quote, it was a case where a few engineers thought it was safe to start the rocket, which in fact it wasn't. And there was a lot of divided labor, and people had gotten used to certain perspectives within their roles in the organization. And then there were pressures to not to have the launch the very day they wanted to. And all these little steps turned into something really terrible. In that case, I think 8 people losing their lives. And it seems in a way so unnecessary. So why does this have to happen? All these seemingly harmless people, and then you have the catastrophe. And that's the kind of constellation that I'm interested in. In a way, I think certain kinds of evils are not very interesting from a theoretical perspective, because they're always going to be people having evil intentions. And in a way, at least from the perspective of the society, that you have to find a way of dealing with it, but it's not something you'll ever get completely rid of. Mm-hmm. Whereas these kind of social structures that lead harmless people to become part to really crimes in a way, that seems something we can work on and should work on.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's a good, helpful distinction, because you're not thinking particularly of cases like, I don't know if you know the case of Enron here in the States, where or it seems like it's a kind of bad seed, or, well, I think it touches on the culture point that you make later, effective.
I think it's bad apples, but there were also a few bad barrels. I mean, that's a distinction that business ethicists sometimes use, bad apples, bad barrels. Uh-huh. I'm mostly interested in the bad barrels, saying that the apples need to take responsibility for the barrels, sort of.
Right. Because one of the reasons I'm sort of pushing on this is I thinking in the back of my mind when I'm reading your book about, say, like an old critique from somebody like Bernard Mandeville, mm-hmm. the old idea of private vice, public benefit. I mean, yours is the inversion of the private vice, public disaster, right?
Not even private vice. I mean, private negligence, disaster,
yeah,
sort of.
Right. So that's, I take it, because what Mandeville is talking about is the sort of personal moral character of economic agents. And that's not particularly what you're interested in, right?
Well, in the end, you get back to it because, well, at least that's what happened to me when I thought through these things. You end up with requirements on individuals as occupiers of certain roles, and you want people to carry certain kinds of responsibilities. So you end up talking about character and what it means to relate to a role and so on. But I wouldn't want to start from the assumption that some people are somehow good or evil or have problematic intentions. So I very much think that for lots of these problems, we need to change the structures instead of trying to re-educate people in some way. Because lots of people, they don't want to be evil. They would probably prefer to be part of a good organization rather than a bad one if they had a choice. But very often they don't have a choice. Or maybe they don't even think about this because they feel that there's no choice to be had because all organizations are the same. And then, of course, they don't even raise these questions for themselves. But maybe I just don't believe very much in telling people to be good. Mm-hmm. I just think that's not how you can bring about real change. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm too pessimistic there, but I think mm-hmm. changing structures is more effective than trying to tell people to be more moral.
Right. Well, there certainly must be studies on the failures of business ethics courses and making people more moral in corporations. but in any case, let's turn to the, I mean, this bears on the first part of your book. Your book's structured in three parts. And the first part really sets the context for the moral discussion, which brings up again the point that you made earlier about the Hegelian ethical life feature of your moral analysis, that you're talking about moral responsibility in a certain kind of social context. So not particularly from the perspective of individuals, but from the perspective of the way in which individuals find themselves in certain kinds of environments that shape their behavior in certain deep ways. So the first part of the book talks about the way in which there's a kind of classic problem in philosophy between the freedom and responsibility on the one hand, and a kind of determinism according to social environment, and how those things go together. And there's a kind of continuum, I guess, on different kinds of explanations of it. There's a sort of libertarian view on the one hand that, you know, places all the power and agency in the hands of individuals to act even despite their circumstances, too, all the way towards a view that individuals find themselves thoroughly determined and embedded in certain in the social context in which they find themselves. So where do you stand on this? Presumably somewhere in between.
Well, that's correct.
Good. And how does it bear on the organizational discussion?
Yeah. So the way you described it, and I think that's a good first approximation, is that it's a one-dimensional spectrum from full responsibility to no responsibility. I think one needs to introduce a more complex picture of human nature, because I think all of us are sometimes very responsible and sometimes completely irresponsible, because we do lots of things in a habitual way where we are used to our environment. We've sort of embodied certain tools, like when you use your computer, for example, typing or whatever. It's the whole constellation of the individual and the environment, the material and the immaterial environment, and together they do something, but they don't think about the details. But then there's also this other side of human nature, which is that we can step back from our immediate context and we can reflect on them and we can compare them to other contexts, for example, we can think critically about them. So the argument that I want to make there is to say, well, we all have these two sides, and we need to make sure from the perspective of our more responsible selves that when we are in this less responsible mode, the context is such that this is actually morally permissible and doesn't lead to any kind of disaster. So a very simple example is that when sometimes it's totally okay to not be attentive. When you sit on a train, you don't have to be attentive to the environment. But when you're at the wheel of a car, you do have to be attentive to the environment. So it's these kinds of distinctions that matter a lot. And of course, very often, we can't shape our context just by our own. So this is often a collective responsibility that we share with others. If you think, for example, about a hospital and the way they manage their processes, if you always put a certain medication in one place, and then the nurses are used to getting it from there when they have to rush to an emergency, and then someone misplaces the bottle or puts something else there, that could easily lead to a disaster. And maybe you wouldn't want to blame the individual nurse who then grabbed the bottle and it was the wrong one, because she was relying on her social context and she should have been able to rely on that context, and someone undermined that. So that's the kind of picture that I try to draw, that we are both responsible but also sometimes irresponsible. And so we need to take care of our context together so that our irresponsible kind of behavior doesn't lead to moral disasters.
Yeah, that's helpful. I mean, so the environment, the organizational environment or organizational culture should, on the one hand, foster or guide behavior towards the right ends when we have our minds turned off or in what is it, system one or system two, anyway, in the psychology.
Yeah, the VoIP psychologists talk about it, but they do emphasize that it's not like essentializing different modes, it's more a shorthand.
So it should do that on the one hand, but also should sort of raise reflection or moral reflection at certain crucial points when there are exceptions or the system breaks down or something. So that sort of the environment is crucial in your view for those two sort of moral ends. Is that right?
Yes. And I don't say it's easy, because the more we optimize the environment to function well, the less attentive we become. So we might then not realize that the environment isn't actually suitable anymore for, I don't know, changed circumstances. So it's not a thing that can be done once and for all, but that needs to be reevaluated from time to time. And I guess it depends very much on the organization, how you would do this in practice. But I mean, lots of hospitals do have kind of quality management circles and feedback mechanisms where they try to discuss these things and try to make sure that they, on the one hand, don't demand too much from individuals when they are under stress and trying to get something done. And on the other hand, not become blindly reliant on the environment.
Yeah. The hospitals are a great example, because as far as I understand this, in the past 20, 30 years, there have been an introduction of, you know, very kind of rigid procedures for everyone to follow through. You know, before surgery happens, the whole team has to get together and go through the checklist in order to.
Yeah.
And that's a case in which, I mean, this is, your view is quite interesting, because it, you know, if I'm understanding it, it's like some cases individual agency is good to foster, but in other cases it's actually bad, right? We don't want, you know, individual arbitrary agency right before surgery. We want to actually to regularize that.
Yeah, well, because there is a certain sort of organizational knowledge base about what should happen before an operation to go ahead, and it's pretty unlikely that an individual is making a better decision than all the knowledge that went into these rules. But of course, that only holds if the rules are really good, and also if the situations are relevantly similar. If you have new situations, fastly changing environments, then just relying on sort of all the aggregated knowledge of the past can be pretty dangerous.
Yeah, that's great.
And by the way, it's quite interesting to see that the medical examples and the cases from medical organizations, that's the one area where this has actually been discussed a lot before, whereas for other organizations, this somehow hasn't been in the focus of attention of philosophers and business ethicists. I guess in for medical cases, it's just obvious that so much is at stake. But then if you think about a chemical plant or airplanes or, I mean, lots of other things, there is actually also a lot of at stake. It's just not so immediate that we see that human lives are at stake. And somehow our moral compass seems to be tied very much to preventing immediate harms to specific individuals, not so much to preventing harms that are more, that have a likelihood but no certainty and that concern strangers.
Yeah, yeah. But as far as, I understand this, there's a lot more, it's a lot easier to get data, I think, on some of this. I mean, that there's a sort of repetitive feature. There are lots and lots and lots of surgeries that are done worldwide every day, and you can very quickly gather data and see what sort of strategies work and what don't. And that has quite clearly affected. Whereas, other industries, it might be more difficult to. I mean, in some cases.
Well, they do have routines in some cases. So,
yeah.
Like safety protocols and so on. So it's not as if there was no
right.
care taken in other industries. What I was saying is that somehow philosophers and business ethicists don't seem to have very much taken into account how all these things work in practice. So a lot of the business ethics literature, for example, was very much focusing on points at which managers had to make difficult decisions, like in moral dilemmas or so, which is, of course, also very important, but it's just not the whole picture of the sort of ethical life of organizations.
Yeah, that's good. Good. Yeah, so let's talk about the second part of the book, where you talk about the main moral challenges in organizational life, which sort of touch on some of the things that we've been talking about already. But you identify a few different features of organizations that make that pose special moral challenges that should be addressed. And I think you did a nice job in sort of bringing these different features out. I hadn't thought about these particular issues in this way, and so it was great. So you talk about the nature of rules, of the use of knowledge in organizations, the organizational culture, and the nature of the self in organizations. So I thought we could talk briefly about each one because they're all quite interesting. So to talk about rules, and I think the way you talk about rules is quite generalizable to political life. I mean, it's a sort of classic problem that rules or laws face in any circumstance, which is that rules are universal principles that are meant to guide behavior in all circumstances. But the problem is there are certain special circumstances in which that particular rule is not appropriate, or in fact can produce the wrong outcome. And so maybe you could talk a little bit about this. It's a sort of classic problem of rules as it's applied to organizations, and is it significantly different, or is it relevantly different than sort of the broader problem with laws in politics?
Well, I think on a general level, it's similar to what you described, the general issue that on the one hand there are certain things we need to generalize, and maybe we need to have certain standards that apply equally to everyone, and then we have cases where it just doesn't work if you apply the rules. There is one additional factor in organizations, which you sometimes have in other parts of life as well, but particularly in organizations, because they are all about divided labor. And when you have divided labor, then you often need to rely on others to do their job, because only then can you do your own job in a meaningful way. And if you have any gaps in these chains of responsibility, that's where moral disasters can sometimes happen. And so the reliance on other people doing their jobs and things being done in a certain way can be greater. So there's more at stake, as it were, than in some other parts of life. And that's why sometimes you get people who, or when you think about it and at first glance, it might seem that it's really always the moral individuals against the rules, and the rules are somehow morally neutral. And what matters is that the individual with their moral purposes or whatever can somehow get around the rules or are given preference over the rules. But if or in many contexts, rules actually do have moral weight, because if you don't stick to the rules, someone is going to be treated unfairly, or some kind of processes are not going to be done well anymore, and that's going to have further consequences. So in a way, there's moral weight on both sides. And that's what makes it so complicated, because otherwise you could just say, well, the rules are just rules of thumb and we should override them whenever that's necessary.
Yeah. So do you think it's better to revise the rules or to carve out exceptions to the rules, or maybe both?
Well, the way that I try to answer that question and address this tension in the book is to say that we need what I call safety vaults. So the rules are like a general structure, like you could say what Weber called the iron cage, although that's a mistranslation, but anyway. So when you have real-life processes, you're always going to have exceptions and atypical cases and so on. So there need to be ways that are written into the rules of how you can deal with these atypical cases. And often that means that you need to be able to challenge the rules internally, have the possibility of having, for example, a committee that looks at atypical cases, because if the rules are applied in a sort of blind way, you force those who have to apply them to act against their moral conscience. And if they do this for a number of years, it's not surprising if they then become totally numb from a moral perspective and don't even look at the particular cases anymore. So I wouldn't opt for rules that have lots of complicated exceptions, but rather for general rules, and then the possibility of making exceptions, but to make this a matter of human judgment. Probably not of one individual person, because individuals are prone to be biased or whatever, but to have possibilities of escalating atypical cases and to have committee decisions, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do you see organizations moving in the direction of overdoing it on rules or underdoing it on rules?
Oh, everyone's overdoing it at the moment, I think. And I think that has a lot to do with legal accountability. And organizations try to have rules in order to be safe from criticism and maybe even lawsuits, because they made rules for their employees. And so if something went wrong, it was the employee who didn't follow the rules. And so there is a tendency, because of that legal pressure, to have lots and lots of rules that no one can ever memorize. And again, a different factor, which I don't discuss in the book, but which became clear to me more recently, is that with the digital transformation, there are so many things that we can measure, that we can make even more rules and try to have generalizations. But that doesn't mean that if you can measure something, that's the thing we should actually measure, because it might just be what's easy to measure and not what's important to measure. And so I think there is a huge danger at the moment that we try to have rules everywhere and maybe even encode them in algorithms. But in lots of cases, life is just different from what the rules say, and too complicated and too you could also say too interesting. I mean, it would be boring if it was all just the rules and they would be easy to apply.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to, I mean, I think of this particularly in the case of universities, of course, because this is our life after all, but certainly this is the tendency in the direction of the university to move, and, you know, this sort of ubiquity of rules and the ubiquity of metrics for evaluating faculty members and staff and so forth. I mean, it's hard for me to know how to reverse that trend, especially given the kinds of incentive that you pointed to about sort of risk management when it comes to organizations. Yeah. This is particularly true in the case of for-profit institutions, and I think even more so nowadays. But what would you say to, you know, university presidents if you could sit them down? And
well, we have a grant proposal on meaningful accountability that we wrote a while ago, because that really is sort of the key question. And by the way, I don't think it's only in for-profit organizations, because in public organizations, there's a lot of demand for accountability towards taxpayers. Mm. And there's also this idea, well, if you use public money, you need to justify what you're doing. And as such, that's not a bad idea. The question is how you actually try to measure it. As a general direction, I would say we need much more human judgment by peers instead of blind application of algorithms and metrics and so on. And I mean, in philosophy, it's particularly absurd to use citation indexes, for example, because if you write a really bad paper, lots of people are going to quote you just in a footnote saying, there's this absurd view out there.
Yeah,
and you get lots of quotations with a really bad paper. So in a way, it's really the wrong incentives that you said when you look at just the numbers. So I'd say use human judgment more often, but there is a history behind all this accountability madness, if you like, which is that human judgment, committees, whatever, can also be very biased. They can be cliquey, can be in-group and out-group things. They have often discriminated against women or people of color and so on. So if you want to combine the sort of standardization that these general rules try to give you and avoid the overregulation by rules, one way of doing it would be to say you have sort of minimum standards that are the same for everyone that are set by rules. And then on top of that, we have judgments by human beings that try to see and try to really understand what someone was doing, why they failed to do certain things, why they managed in other cases to get what they wanted to do, but maybe they were just lucky. So sort of have a certain floor of rules to create reliability for everyone, and then human judgment on top of that.
Right. And presumably the human judgment is revisable and open to sort of democratic committees and so forth, right?
And dictated from on high. You need to put them together wisely and think about the different constellations of who should be in that, of course. And that's maybe more an art than a science, because it depends very much on the local context. So I don't think you can have like recipes for that.
Yeah, I mean, as an example, you talk about the codes of ethics that you're seeing more and more. I was surprised to see, I mean, you're sort of critical of the proliferation of them. Not, you're obviously not a critic of ethical behavior, because that's what the book is about, but codes of ethics, you suggest, are sort of counterproductive. Maybe you could say a bit about that.
I think they can be counterproductive if they tell people obvious things like be friendly to your colleagues or treat your customers well. People feel offended, and in a way, that's understandable, because that's the kind of things that grown-ups would do anyway. And often these codes of ethics are handed out to people without asking the more important question, namely, how are the incentives structured such that people might not be friendly to their colleagues or not treat their customers well, for example, because they are not given enough time to actually do this. So I think it can be very hypocritical. It can also come with good intentions, but then I think it should never only be a code of ethics that's being solemnly declared. There should also be other measures about the implementation and about giving people the scope of agency that they need in order to act according to these ethical rules.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of discussions about codes of ethics these days, I think particularly connected to the Me Too movement. So certainly on the university campus, see some of this. And then, but also I think more relevantly, you see at the political level in the United States about codes of ethics being called for elected officials, say Trump to disclose track.
Famous American public official is probably not going to stick to the rules of whatever code of ethics you put up. I mean, So in a way, What's the point if those who get most attention, who are supposed to be the role models, if they don't stick to these codes, then it just doesn't cut any ice, I think.
You talk about knowledge, which fits in with the discussion about the division of labor that's central to the book. So this is a problem that organizations have, because organizations are characterized by the division and especially specialization of labor. And so you have some individuals who are experts in an organization, and they, say, do some research and find out about something, and they have a particular insight into something, but they have to communicate that to others or to higher-ups who make decisions. And so there's a kind of challenge about how to transmit knowledge across an organization that's characterized by this division of specialization of labor. You could talk about that. I mean, particularly the moral dimensions of it, or the moral issues or moral challenges that are raised by this knowledge problem.
Yes, that was actually one of the things that came out of the interviews. I had not thought about it before, or not in that way. And for me, that was a really exciting moment to discover this whole universe of questions that you get because of divided knowledge. Before, I had a pretty naive view of somehow organizations gathering information from all the employees and then somehow aggregating it and making decision based on that information. But actually, in lots of organizations, knowledge is really something that is more like a battleground, and who knows what, who gets which information, what do you include into the reports and what do you not include. That's usually political, if you like. And often it can be challenging for people who are lower in the hierarchies to communicate important information or pieces of knowledge to someone who's higher up, because if you are the superior supposed to give orders to other people, then it can be psychologically challenging to also keep in mind that you depend on these people's knowledge and that the information that they can give you. So there is sort of this inverse relationship. There's most information and knowledge at the bottom of organizations, and it's needed at the top, but the incentives to openly share knowledge from the bottom to the top, and also the willingness to listen to those at the bottom, that often doesn't work very well. And the situation you described about one individual finding out about something and trying to communicate it, that was something that I encountered in a couple of interviews. People had somehow learned about something or found out something that seemed morally relevant, and suddenly they felt that they had this huge responsibility about what they would do with this piece of information. Should they just keep silent? Should they escalate it? Should they maybe even become whistleblowers? So go to outside organizations, like talk to a journalist, whatever. And that were really difficult questions that people struggled with, because the knowledge they had, in a way, it gave them power and they were able to influence certain outcomes. And that, of course, also raises question about moral responsibility. What do we do if we find out something that might have moral implications, but often we don't even know whether it's going to have them? We might have a hunch. Is it hunch?
Hunch, yeah.
Hunch, sorry, we might have a hunch. we might have a hunch that there is something somehow fishy or dangerous or delicate going on, but before we talk to others, it's difficult to see the whole picture. And then that's what divided labor is like. We only see certain slices of reality and others see other slices. And in order to prevent morally dangerous knowledge gaps, we need to share information, but often the incentives in organizations and also the culture in organization are not very knowledge friendly.
Right. And so I can think of two different ways in which knowledge is influential here. On the one hand, I'm thinking of cases, and I think maybe these are the cases you have in mind, where you have an individual who identifies a kind of problem that with the products or with the service that the organization is producing that could have harmful effects and that the organization hasn't noticed. And that individual tries to communicate that knowledge and sort of shut down from on top. I mean, I think the other kind of knowledge transmission is something like, the organization is trying to know how to improve or what to do. And there are a variety of different individuals who are giving their input on how best to improve the product, the widget, or whatever. And one individual thinks, you know, is an expert, and they suggest something, and they're shut down in favor of another individual. I take it you have in mind more of the first kind of problem. I mean, that's the problem where it raises more moral issues. Is that right?
Yes. Well, that's sort of the way you set it up. The first one has a moral relevance. The other is more about efficiency or earning money, which can also be important, of course. And if you have one engineer in a company who has the key idea for how to improve a product such that the company can survive, that also gains moral weight because lots of jobs are at stake and so on. So I think it's not a clear division. There can be a spectrum between the two cases that you described. But because I focus on moral questions in the book, it's more the first kind of case that I have in mind. And it's quite interesting. So I've written a paper together with a colleague, Felix Galsbeck, after the book. If you look at arguments in epistemic democratic theory about why democratic structures help us to gather knowledge and that can lead to good decisions, hopefully. Mm-hmm. Some of these are actually also applicable to organizations. Like you need the knowledge of the many in order to get all the ideas on the table, see things from different perspectives, see problems early on, be able to reverse decisions if they turn out to be wrong. And in a way, that's a similar problem for large organizations, because they have all these people as their employees, the managers, and so on. But how do they make sure that the knowledge of everyone is actually being sort of counted when it comes to decisions?
Yeah, I was thinking about this when I was speaking earlier, because it strikes me as a classic problem for any political. I remember in Plato's Statesman talks about this very issue. I mean, how is it that a political community can aggregate the knowledge of its members? And yeah, I mean, I think this bears directly on issues in democratic theory. So I maybe you could say a little bit about how you think organizations can sort of best handle this issue. And I'm thinking particularly, because I think you have a kind of democratic take on this, what you think of, you know, challenges to the kind of epistemic democracy view, the ones that, well, sort of older tradition of critics of democracy who see the sort of aggregation from the bottom up as problematic, and we need more sort of top down agency. So what's your view? Yeah.
Well, if I already had a fully developed view, then the book that I tried to write at the moment would be easier to do. But that's what I'm working on at the moment. So I'm taking this knowledge issue from the context of organizations into the open of political society as a whole, because I got really interested in this, and then there were all these debates about fake news and public lies and so on. So I think it's a core question for democratic societies, how to deal with different forms of knowledge held by different people. If you have certain forms of expertise, it's very hard to control that from the outside, because everyone who knows about these things is sort of already part of that group. So can we trust them? And I think the line that I want to take is what I call Republican functionalism. And the idea is that if we think of ourselves as members of a democratic republic, we have a co-responsibility, each of us, to deal with knowledge in certain ways. And so knowledge can never be just a private good, a private property. There are huge problems about private companies having property rights over knowledge and having property rights over mechanisms of transmitting knowledge to others. So I think as democratic societies, we really need to have a look at how new technologies have changed the conditions of how knowledge is actually dealt with. And what I think is a useful way of approaching it is to distinguish between knowledge that should be shared widely, that everyone needs to have, and knowledge that is too specialized, so that it doesn't make sense for everyone to have it, but we still need it to be used in a way that doesn't harm society and ideally supports democratic aims and democratic values. So there is a difference between common knowledge, if you like, and expert knowledge. And for expert knowledge, I think it's very interesting to think about it by drawing on the older tradition of professionalism, where the idea really is, if you're a professional, you're sort of a guardian for certain kinds of knowledge or certain forms of expertise, and you're not allowed to use it just for your own profits. You have to use it in certain ways to take other people's interests into account.
Yeah, so how do you think organizations can implement this kind of vision of Republican, what did you call it, Republican?
Functionalism. Well, I mean, in the best of all possible worlds, that it will be democratically run, I guess. Well, I'm not 100% sure, but I think that's the direction where we should go. Because one interesting feature about knowledge is that unless you use torture, which we shouldn't, you need people to volunteer knowledge. So you need people to be cooperative. And for people to be cooperative, it's a natural thing, and also, I think, morally justified, that they expect to be taken seriously and not to be exploited and to be seen as moral equals, even if they are within hierarchies. There is no general problem about being in hierarchies if there are certain democratic checks and balances in place. And I think so, in order to optimally harness the knowledge of all employees, going democratic is really the best way for companies.
Good, yeah. And by going democratic, democratizing the workplace, do you have in mind particularly the sort of German model of having workers on the boards of directors, or do you have in mind the sort of turning corporations into co-ops kind of idea? What do you have in mind?
I think both are possibilities, and I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all solution. The German model goes pretty far in terms of co-determination, but there's always a majority for the side of capital. So in that sense, it's not fully democratized companies. I think we are at a point in time where we need a lot of experimentation with different models in order to see what works, how we can use new technologies to make decisions in more democratic ways, which models work for which industries, under which contexts, how could the legal framework support democratic decision making. I'd hesitate to say, sort of from the philosopher's armchair, that this model is going to be the one that's going to work for all kinds of organizations. I think that that would be unrealistic. I think we might need co-ops in some areas and co-determination, but with a majority for the worker side in other areas. And maybe some organizations do need to be hierarchical, but only what's called workplace republicanism in the debate. So strong checks and balances, but no democratic control by workers. Maybe that's okay for certain other areas. So I see a sort of mixed environment and a rich ecosystem where you have different approaches, but definitely different from what we see today. I think such a system would be much more knowledge friendly than what we see at the moment.
So let's talk about culture. You talk about the organizational culture, which for those of us, anyone who's worked at an unfriendly or really quite toxic culture knows exactly what you're talking about in these chapters. I mean, cultures can be very stultifying, or they can be very enabling, depending on the character of them. And you have a really interesting analysis of how cultures are formed and how they shape individual behavior, but are shaped in turn, and how they're, I found particularly interesting the sort of slippery slope analysis that you give. You call it a practical slippery slope, that, you know, when one individual acts in a certain way, it sets a precedent that other individuals can then take up, which further entrenches that precedent, and eventually it becomes sort of a bedrock of that culture. You could say a little bit about how organizations have or can manage cultures badly or well.
Well, I think one of the important insights that you get from organizational studies, but also, as you say, from real life experience, is that there are going to be the official rules in every organization, and then there's going to be the culture. And the rules and the hierarchies can never fully determine the culture. But still, the culture is extremely important for how individuals perceive the organization, how they deal with each other, also how they interpret the rules. And so we cannot just neglect this area of culture just because it seems fuzzy and vague and difficult to grasp. What I try to argue is that if we assume an organizational culture needs to be supportive of the moral norms that the organization needs to obey, that, and we cannot directly influence it, then we need to create a situation where a good culture can develop and can flourish. And there is a particular responsibility for leading managers, simply because they are so visible and they set the tone. I mean, in business ethics, you often hear this phrase, setting the tone from the top, or walking the talk. And that may seem like some weird heroic picture of organizational leaders. But I think it's actually a pretty pragmatic observation that there are some people in organizations and everyone sees what they do and reads about them and so on, whereas others are less visible. And so these visible people have a particular responsibility to maintain a culture that really makes it possible for individuals and supports them in taking on their more responsibilities.
Yeah, it strikes me that that's absolutely crucial. I mean, for those of us who have had bad bosses, one of the things that really ticks people off about bosses is when bosses have certain rules and then they themselves violate them. I mean, there's nothing like a sort of hypocritical boss. I mean, it's one thing when you have hypocritical fellow employees, because they're at least at your level, but there's something worse about a boss who takes advantage of the rules, because there's a kind of perception that it's a sort of systematic rigging of the entire process. And so that's a way that the culture can deteriorate quite quickly when you have a leader who doesn't. And by contrast, if you have a leader who sort of, makes sacrifices for the organization, right? That sort of self-sacrifice is a quite interesting sort of motivator, I think, for the benefits or the positive.
Though not all organizations deserve sacrifices, I would
say.
This
is true, right? Right.
No, but absolutely. I mean, I think if we accept that hierarchies have some kind of justification, then those who benefit from being in privileged positions, the bosses, they really need to be aware of their responsibility, and one of responsibilities is to be a good role model and to stand for the values the organization stands for. And I think one of the reasons, I mean, in terms of the broader culture of why this idea is sometimes not as present in people's minds as it should be, or in bosses' minds maybe, is that we have weird ideas about meritocracy and people rising to the top because they are so great as individuals. Mm-hmm. Whereas I would take a much more sort of functional analysis of things. Okay, we need certain people to take on certain leadership roles just because that's what's needed in order to integrate all this divided labor. But then if they get this role, there's really a responsibility there. And as I said, part of that responsibility is to watch out for the organizational culture, try to understand it, which can be quite difficult, actually, because as a boss, you might not get honest feedback. So because you're the boss and you could punish people for being honest. So that's quite an interesting issue. Also, if you're the boss, who do you listen to in order to understand the culture and what's going on in the organization? Maybe quite a few people in these roles would be grateful if they got more honest feedback from employees. But if employees know that they are employed at will and can be fired very easily, you cannot expect them to be fully honest with their bosses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost like there's a kind of, we have these two models of organizational life in mind when we occupy them, more of a sort of transactional Gesellschaft type of relationship where it's sort of, you enter in an organization and it's purely contractual. You have a contractual relationship with manager and fellow employees. And then there's a sort of Gemeinschaft. I think it's unavoidable, a kind of Gemeinschaft relationship with your fellow workers that develop, and a sense of connection and loyalty to the organization, and a sense of appreciation or in other cases, despising your boss. That sort of moral psychology is quite different, I think, in those two cases, but crucially important. I mean, I don't know if you, this gets a little bit beyond your book, but I don't know if you've thought about that, how those two different models coexist and how they come into tension with one another.
Well, I mean, if you look at all the economic models that have been hugely influential in the last couple of decades, it was a transactional model. And the assumption was that people go to work in order to earn money and they want to minimize the hours they put in and they just work for the money. Social psychology tells us that this is total nonsense and people are motivated by lots of other things. And the social community at work can be very important. So there is this book by Dan Pink on what motivates us to work, and he distinguishes autonomy, mastery and purpose as the three big motivators. And purpose, of course, has a lot to do with the social relations at work, because if you do something for a colleague, then that's part of, or that can be part of purpose. And I mean, this is also a personal experience, which I guess lots of people have had, that if you, for example, need to get something done for someone else to take over and you agree on a deadline and so on, that really makes you do this thing, even though it may not be any kind of hard deadline. It's just because you don't want to disappoint other people and you want to be a good colleague. And the question is, can we build organizations such that this positive, spontaneous relationship between colleagues can develop? The really hard problem, I guess, is if you do have the toxic atmosphere, what can you do to get out of it? And maybe sometimes just need to separate individuals into different units. Some people just don't seem to mix very well. And well, it can be pretty difficult once the battles are entrenched and people think about camps that they all belong to and so on. And there are all these old stories that they carry as their baggage along with them. I don't think there are easy answers to that. But what I do see as a positive example in some organizations, that they have pretty good coaches, therapists who look at teams and talk to them as groups, but also as individuals, to try to address issues when they arise and not to let them sit there for years and then sort of build up all these hard tensions between people. And of course, that's sort of a luxury solution because that's not feasible in many organizations. But I think some form of process in which these things can be talked about and people can try to understand each other's perspective, that could be very helpful in many cases.
So let's talk, the last challenge that you talk about is thinking about the nature of the self in organizations, which is was quite an interesting chapter, because you talk about how when individuals enter into organizations, how they think of themselves in relation to the roles that they occupy and the overall organizational hierarchy. And as you say, individuals can do it in a couple different ways. On the one hand, we can have a sort of strong, I think you called it a strong identification with our roles, in which we fully and thoroughly occupy the persona or the roles and are indistinguishable from it. I thought of this in the context of the TV show Mad Men, right? It's a sort of falling into it and then becoming, you know, realizing the nihilism at the heart of the advertising life. In any case, on the other hand, it can be, as you call it, a kind of coat model, where you put on a coat or put on a hat, whichever metaphor you want to use, when you enter into the on the day, and you can take it off when you go home, and it's And those two different models you find problematic in different ways, and opt for what you call a transformational understanding of the self in its roles. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what you see that's a problem with those other different approaches, and what the transformational approach is and how it improves on the different other accounts.
Yeah, I mean, of course, these are very schematic models, and the reality is always somewhere in between, I guess, but you need models to think about these things. So the code model is people trying to keep an inner distance to whatever they have to do in their jobs and not to put too much energy, too much of themselves into these roles. And that can seem to be healthy because, epistemically speaking, they keep a distance. They can be self-critical. They see what might be going wrong in the organization and so on. But psychologically speaking, it can be very, very demanding. And it's just not realistic to think that we can always, for years and years, have this kind of distance. And also, it's not the ideal model if you want to think about people as sort of responsible citizens within organizations, also making efforts to improve the organizations. The code model person is too distanced from that. They wouldn't want to make all these efforts to improve things in their jobs. On the other hand, if you have the sort of over-identification of wanting to make your professional or occupational role part of yourself, then the danger is that you lose any form of critical distance and you just try to become that kind of person without asking the question of whether it's actually worthwhile and morally permissible and morally valuable to become that kind of person, or whether it the kind of role description would need to be changed in some ways. And so it's like both of these models are they create hurdles for being the kind of morally responsible citizens within organizations that we would like to be and that we would want others to be as well. So the transformational model that I suggest is one where we are sort of in a constant dialogue with this professional or occupational role that we have, but we don't completely identify and we question it in regular intervals, and we try to understand what's going on there, how it's shaping us. And I mean, I haven't sort of invented this. It was sort of my way of trying to grasp some the way in which some of my interviewees, typically older ones actually, who had gone through this for many, many years, had tried to deal with their roles and the moral challenges they brought. So it was never complete identification, but also not this kind of distant, almost blasé relation of the code model. It was struggling with a role and then trying to bring one's own values within the organization and hopefully thereby to transform the organization in the long run. That's where the name comes from.
And the transformation, is there transformation of our broader self or the transformation of our particular role or persona within the organization? I'm just trying to get a handle on what's being transformed, I guess.
Well, I guess the first answer would be hopefully if you have these kinds of people in organizations, the organizations would be transformed because they wouldn't be the kind of purely transactional instrumental spaces and more kind of Gemeinschaften, as you said before, where people can really live up to their moral responsibilities and relate to each other in productive ways and so on. But of course, I think it's totally unrealistic to think that our roles and the way we struggle with them doesn't also transform us. I mean, not only roles at work, and the same goes for other roles. And I think that's just the way we make experiences through our jobs, in our jobs, and hopefully, I mean, there's always this thing, if you say, well, people are going to change, the question is, are they going to learn, become wiser, understand things in a deeper way, or are they just starting to rationalize things, become cynical, just accept things as they are? And the question is, how can we get on the first trajectory and not the second, of course?
Yeah, so let's conclude by talking a couple, you know, sort of, I guess, broader questions about the project. I mean, one of the questions that occurred to me in reading the book is, you could say a sort of, you know, broadly Marx, I guess, inspired question that relates to specifically kind of for-profit organizations, which is, well, okay, so let's say for-profit organizations sort of undertake some of the moral reforms that you're talking about. And I think some American corporations are moving in this direction. I mean, you can see a lot of American corporations sort of making some broad gestures towards sort of moral aims. They've been more kind of political aims and sort of political signaling going on. But I suppose one way one might think about this is a sort of, what prevents some of these moral efforts becoming sort of cynically co-opted by a sort of profit motive, as it were, being a sort of window dressing, you know, it's the new moral company that, you know, is free trade, fair trade, free earth or whatever, you know, but which helps it sell more coffee.
Yeah, no, I know there's a huge danger of hypocrisy in all this. On the other hand, I would say that sometimes you have people within these companies who can take advantage of the official declarations and then actually push for what has been promised in a totally instrumental way. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we should be too quick to reject these official declarations as just being hypocritical. But of course, if you have a competitive environment, there is still a question of, can these companies survive? Are they going to be outcompeted by others? How serious can they be? And in a way, that was why, at the end of this part about the four different kinds of challenges, I realized I cannot just stop there and say, okay, now we can say how individuals and organizations should do it. We also need to talk more about the political framework. And of course, if you are a certain kind of Marxist, then you wouldn't think that the political system can have any kind of power to set a frame for the market. I don't think I'm that kind of Marxist, but then I also live in Europe, so I don't know whether that makes a difference. Anyway, but if you're not that kind of Marxist, but if you still take the competitive pressures on companies seriously, then one very important political implication of the things we've been talking about is that the political framework for markets needs to be such that companies can do what's morally right without being outcompeted.
Right.
So there is a political dimension to all these things that I really think is very important to keep in mind.
Right. Because that's one of the broad, I guess, feasibility questions is, can efficiency in the organization's output be combined with these moral imperatives? It sounds like the answer is yes, they can be, so long as it's within a framework that government regulation sets up.
Well, and the problem is, of course, that we live in a globalized world and we don't have a world government, which is probably not a thing to aim for anyway. But if you have a global economy and very few shared standards, then this is all terribly complicated and difficult. But on the other hand, maybe one of the things that makes me more optimistic than others might be is that the German economy has quite a few companies that function somewhat along the lines I'm describing in the book. I'm not saying it's perfect and I don't want to justify any particular practices, but what's relevant is that they deviate quite a lot from the economic models that tell you that these kinds of companies are going to be outcompeted by market in markets, and yet they flourish and they make profits and it works. And that's a reason for me to think that this is not all set in stone, and sort of the standard Marxist story is a little bit too deterministic. And depending on the political framework, also depending on the kinds of customers you serve, the kinds of products you have, the kinds of expertise you need to use, there is much more flexibility in how companies can operate. But it does take creativity and it takes certain kind of practical wisdom to see the opportunities that companies can have. And one thing that I'm not at all optimistic about is the kind of selection processes for corporate leaders and maybe also leaders in public institutions, whether it gives us the kind of people who would be good at making these moral judgments, finding creative moral solutions and so on, or whether the ones who make it to the top are the ruthless profit maximizers.
So you do not have to answer this, but I should ask it because it occurs to me. Do you have any examples of organizations that you think work really well according to this moral model? And I ask because let me know and then I'll buy from them. I buy things from them.
Well, I'm not going to give you names of companies,
okay,
but let
good.
Me say
That's
one
fine.
Thing.
Yeah.
This is anecdotal, so I don't have data, but from anecdotal evidence, it seems that B2B, companies that are active in B2B markets, where it's really technical experts that evaluate the quality of products, sometimes they seem to have a much larger scope of agency for being responsible moral companies, because for them, it's really the quality that matters, and it's not like shallow consumer preferences that are basically just constructed by advertisement, but it's really other experts evaluating their products, and that means they have to focus on producing them in a good way. So, as I said, I won't give you any names, but I'm thinking about things like medical equipment or stuff where they are not very visible because they don't advertise to end consumers, but I got the impression that there are actually pretty well-functioning, morally responsible companies in many of these niche markets that aren't quite so niche if you look at the numbers. And one key question, I guess, is for companies that produce stuff for end consumers, do consumers want the morally responsible companies or not? And how much are they willing to pay for morally responsibly produced products and services? And also, how can companies really credibly signal that they are different from other companies? That's a challenge. And if you look, for example, at fair trade labels, there are lots of free riders with other labels that look similar but actually have much lower standards. So there is a huge information war, if you like, about which companies have which ethical standards that try to reach different groups of consumers. Maybe technical solutions could be envisaged here. So you could have, I don't know, Skype-ins with employees of companies to see whether it's really a better company, but then of course it can be manipulated. So there is a huge information processing issue between companies and the kinds of consumers who want to buy from responsible companies. And that's, I think, something we're right in the middle of.
Yeah, so this is the last question. I wanted to ask about the view of the division of labor, which I found quite exciting in the book. And you take inspiration from Durkheim in part in your analysis of the division of labor. I'm thinking that this part of your book near the end, where you talk about how even within a system of division of labor, we can still find meaningful work. And I was hoping that maybe you expand a little bit on that and defend that a little bit, because one of the things that occurs to me in thinking about the division and specialization of labor is the way in which it really bifurcates society into, you know, a group that does all the sort of creative and intellectual work and meaningful work, indeed, and then the group in society that does all the drudgery and has the sort of less meaningful work. How is it that, I mean, one, we can avoid that kind of bifurcation, but also, two, that what justifies your optimism, I guess, is one way of putting it, about that meaningful work can be shared across this divide?
That's a huge question.
So yeah, I got to end with that, right?
It's not going to be like the full answer. But so one really important distinction that is not talked about often enough is between the technical division of labor and the social division of labor. The technical division of labor means that you divide work into different steps and then you can have machines doing some of them and so on. That's what gives you the huge efficiency gains. Then there's the social division of labor, which is who actually does these tasks. And if you think about, for example, Adam Smith's pin factory, he talks about 10 people doing single different steps. You could also imagine one person doing one step one day and then the next step the next day. So this person would have a much more diverse set of activities. It would still not be super interesting and probably physically demanding, but it would not be the same thing day in, day out.
And they would see the totality of the process too.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. They would see the whole thing. They could feel proud of what they've produced. Mm-hmm. So it would be a totally different relation to their work. And I think that's something that we could use as an insight for thinking about how we design institutions. Who's actually going to do which tasks? Where can we have a rotation of different jobs? How can we divide the different tasks also over the course of people's lifetime? I mean, certain kinds of jobs are okay if you do them as a side job while you're a student, but they would be horrible if you had to do them full time later in life and so on. So I think the social division of labor is something where societies really can make decisions by the legal framework, by tax incentives and so on, about how that works. I have a PhD student, Frauke Schmode, who works on one question that is implied in your question here, namely what to do about the really bad work that none of us wants to do. She argues that there should be an egalitarian distribution of bad work. So all of us should do some of it, maybe for 1 year of our lives or whatever. That may seem radical, but I think she's convinced me that this is the way to think about it. Also, some drudgery might be taken over by robots in the future. So robots and algorithms are good at repetitive work. And so what is really sort of what makes work bad for humans, namely that it's the same thing over and over again, is actually what makes robots good at it, because they can learn and improve on it if you use artificial intelligence and so on. They need the repetition to improve. So I think a lot is going to depend on how we divide work between robots and human beings in the future. And of course, as long as we have profit maximizing companies, they're going to decide by looking at costs. So there is a question of how we regulate minimum wages, how we tax labor and machinery. I think we're probably going to need some kind of tax on machines, robots, and so on. So I think a lot of it really depends on the political framework, and the division of labor doesn't have to be dehumanizing, but it is a political task. And I think it's a politically really urgent task at the moment because of the technological changes that we're seeing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lisa, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. And thanks to you for listening.